And we will also post those to our website. So let me get the recording of the Zoom meeting itself started. Okay, so again, we are making a recording of today's meeting, and welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Fred Bruins. I coordinate the rulemaking process for the Workers' Compensation Division. We really appreciate your sharing of your time and your knowledge today to help us develop effective rules. There's an important agenda item or handout. It's on our website. It's an agenda which actually has in it some draft rules. That agenda is posted to our website, wcd.oregon.gov, under Laws and Rules, and then Rule Hearings and Meetings. Our legal issues coordinator, Kathy Ostrin-Ponchin, will take us through the agenda shortly, and you may find that that's going to be all you need if for any reason you don't have an agenda. You may actually find it more helpful. You will know more in a little while, but whether you may want to just refer to the draft rules at various times during the discussion. This is an advisory committee meeting. We're picking up some background noises, so you may want to selectively use your mute button. Yeah, we're getting a lot of background noise right now, but is everyone else hearing that as well?
Yes.
Okay.
It's coming from username MarshAML.
Oh, thank you. Username MarshAML. We're getting a lot of background noise. Let me see who has requested. I see it's unidentifiable. A377896. No, that's me. There's a couple of people on the telephone with us, and you may want to try your button selectively. Oh, okay, great. Thanks. We do want everybody to participate today, but if you can selectively use your mute buttons, that'll help us avoid. We'll pick up even keyboarding sounds or if anybody comes in and talks to you, that kind of thing. So this is an advisory committee meeting. Unlike a public rulemaking hearing, this is very informal. It's where people give us basically their advice, and it's more of a discussion. We have some department staff members here, but our role is primarily to listen and learn, though we'll answer any questions that we can. The one ground rule I'd like us to observe is to describe problems or obstacles in a way that does not identify specific people or organizations. There's placeholders on our document for fiscal impacts as we review the issues and identify possible alternatives to existing rules. Please give us advice about any fiscal impacts that might result from related rule changes. We would appreciate your advice on how potential rule changes would affect you or the people who you represent. When we file proposed rules with the Secretary of State, we estimate the economic effects of proposed changes, with special emphasis on any effects on small businesses. Each issue on our agenda now has a place to record impacts of possible rule changes on racial equity in Oregon. If you think any changes might have impacts on racial equity, positive or negative, please let us know, because we will have to explain any effects when we file proposed rules with the Secretary of State in compliance with a statute change that was effective on January 1. Please note that we've already covered the background noises, so I had a little note here about reminding you about that. But again, we do want you to fully participate, so at any time you can chime in. In most cases, you can use the hand raise function. But if we miss you for any reason, just speak up. Again, it's very informal. Introductions for virtual meetings can be awkward. No one knows when to speak, so I will call your name. And then if I miss you, you can let us know you are here after I run down our list. Is Kirsten Adams with us this morning? Oh, excuse me. I'm just going to run
yes,
down.
Yes, I am. Good morning.
And Kevin Anderson?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Dave Barenberg? Jennifer Bryson? Kaiser Permanente? Debbie Chan, Portland Public Schools. Melissa Douglas, Kohler & Associates.
I'm here.
Welcome. Andrew Evanson, SBH Legal. Jennifer Flood, Ombudsman for Injured Workers. I'm pretty sure Jennifer is with us.
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, welcome. Jay Fraser, Safe Corporation.
Good morning, Fred. I'm here.
Good morning. Ted Hoyce, Quinn and Hoyce, LLC.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome, Ted. Stacy Hewitt, Kaiser Permanente. Faze Lomax, Sedgwick CMS. Chris Moore, Moore & Jensen.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome, Chris. John Powell, John Powell & Associates. David Pyle, Caremark Comp.
Here on the phone.
Oh, welcome, John. David Pyle, Caremark Comp, MCO.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome, David. Julene Quinn, Quinn & Hoyce, LLC.
Yes, good morning.
Welcome, Julene. Sue Canone, City of Portland. Julie Riddle, The Hartford.
I'm here.
Welcome, Julie. Dan Schmeling, Safe Corporation.
Morning, Fred.
Good morning, Dan. Elaine Schooler, Safe Corporation.
Good morning.
Welcome, Elaine. Kitty Schrantz, Kaiser Permanente. Keith Semple, Johnson & Johnson, Lucas & Middleton. Catherine Shaw, Sedgwick CMS.
Good morning, Fred.
Welcome, Catherine. Sherry Sundstrom, Hoffman Construction. Ashley Willard, Travelers Insurance. Diana Winther, IBEW.
Present. Hi, everyone.
Welcome, Diana. Now, I'm sure I missed some folks, so could you let us know if you're on the connection this morning? Anyone? Well, maybe I did connect with everyone. So I'm just going to run down a list of people from the department that I know are with us. And I know I'm going to miss a few, and then we'll do the same thing at the end, and you can let us know if you're here. So I'm aware that we have joining us this morning Scott Alto, Rob Anderson, James Burke, Yesenia Gonzalez, Sean Haywood, Danica Karma, Kathy Ostrin-Ponchin, Troy Painter, Steve Passantino, Summer Tucker, and Matt West. Are there some additional department staff on the call or on the connection this morning?
Good morning, Fred. This is Stan Fields. Can you hear me?
Welcome, Stan. Anyone else?
Fred, this is Amelia Vargas.
Welcome, Amelia.
Jennifer Melloman.
Oh, welcome, Jennifer. Thank you for joining us. Anyone else?
Sarah Clashens.
Welcome, Sarah. Additional? Okay. With that, I'm going to turn the conduct of the meeting over to Kathy Ostrin-Ponchin. So Kathy will take us through our agenda now. Kathy?
Thank you, Fred. If during the meeting, if you would like for Fred to share either of the documents on his screen so that if for some reason you don't have it or don't have access to it, let us know. I kind of like to see who all is participating. And along the same lines, if you raise your hand and you find that no one is noticing, feel free to just unmute yourself and speak up, because I'm with two screens and different documents. I don't want to miss anybody. Let's see. I see a couple of things in the chat. So, Fred, are you seeing that as well?
Yes, I'm seeing.
Diana is asking if you could drop the link, maybe to the documents in the chat. Diana, are you talking about the agenda and the draft rules?
Yeah, I think I can do that.
Yes,
so
I'll work away
okay. Getting that link, and then it should just take a moment.
And Fred, you're muted.
Oh, sorry. Yes, I apologize. Yes, I will work at getting that link in the chat window so you can just link to our website and get the agenda that way if you'd like. Thank you, Diana. I should have thought of that.
So So as Fred said, I am the legal issues coordinator for the Workers' Compensation Division. The Division 1 rules fall under my responsibility, so if there's an issue that needs to be addressed in Division 1, I'm the analyst that will do that. So the primary issue today is attorney fees. Many of you joined us for a meeting in October, but I know many of you were not in that meeting, so I'm going to give a little bit of background about why we're here today. The first issue, so we're looking at issue number one on the issues document, is regarding attorney fees under 656.383 subsection 1. And that provision says that the claimant's attorney, let's see, I'm going to go back a little bit. The claimant's attorney shall be allowed a reasonable assessed attorney fee if the claimant's attorney is instrumental in obtaining temporary disability compensation benefits pursuant to, and it lists a string of statutes, one of which is 656.268, prior to a decision by an administrative law judge. That provision has been in the statute since 2006, and previously the division had taken the position that it didn't apply at the reconsideration process before the appellate review unit, and prior board cases had upheld that. But the Court of Appeals issued an opinion in Dancing Bear versus Safe in September, holding that ORS 656.383 subsection 1 entitles claimants' attorneys to fees after they obtain temporary disability benefits for claimants in proceedings on reconsideration pursuant to ORS 656.268. And so when that opinion came out, and the opinion was not appealed, and so it is final, or will be. I don't know if the appellate judgment's issued yet, but the statute nor the court's opinion provide a lot of guidance on what that looks like. Other parts of the statute will provide more. Hi, David. Are you? We can hear you. I don't know if you are sharing down the question. Okay. Provide a lot of guidance on what that process looks like before the appellate review unit and what the division's role is. So we held an initial meeting in October to talk about it. At that time, we weren't sure if we were going to move forward with rulemaking or not. But after that meeting and having some further discussions, we have put together a draft rule. And the rules document that's attached to the agenda is on pages 4 and 5. I apologize that I cut over 2 pages. It's a little bit harder to read that way. But it provides that for the insurer to determine the amount of the fee and to pay to the worker's attorney a fee if, and there's a list of criteria, if the worker disagrees with the temporary disability date shown on the notice of closure and is raised as an issue in the request for reconsideration, the reconsideration order that is issued modifies the disability dates. As a result of the modification of those dates, the insurer determines that additional temporary disability compensation benefits are due and payable to the worker, and the worker is represented by an attorney. And there's a table provided in Section 2 of the rule for the amount of the fee. And then we provide that the fee would be in addition to the already existing fee under 2686C. That's the 10% fee. And so we would like to hear feedback from you on what this is, what the rule so far, recognizing that some of the issues, as we talked about in October, with the statute are still going to be litigated. And so it's not... all of our questions are not answered at this point in time. But if anyone wants to get started with just letting us know your feedback on what we've got here in the draft rules, we would appreciate that. And I'll just kind of open it up. I'll keep an eye out for hands, or otherwise feel free to unmute. I'll just go on to say that in the table in Section 2 of the rule, we did look at what some of the fees were awarded by the ALJs and the board under 383. We also looked at the range of fees that are awarded in medical disputes before the medical resolution team and tried to keep within the range of what those fees are, so that we're kind of staying in line with fees. Julian, did you come off mute there? Why don't you go ahead?
Well, I don't really want to jump in ahead of other claimants' attorneys. We did talk about the rule, and first of all, I appreciate the department's efforts. This is not an easy issue to get your hands around, and so we appreciate you taking sort of first crack at this, and know that we will be, you know, picking at it because you've put up a target there, if you will. But we appreciate that the department has taken this effort. A few comments about this in terms of sort of the overall issue. What you're going to find with most reconsideration cases is that they're easy. Most of them are easy. They're going to fall into the regular, you know, reviewing a file, determining temporary disability as an issue, and you know, regular type effort to obtain them. And then you're going to have a smaller percentage, almost the 80-20 rule in life, that 20% of your 10% of time, you're going to have this smaller set of cases where, for example, you've litigated the temporary disability at a hearing and reconsideration, a closure was issued by the insurer to cut off that litigation, where now you have to take all that litigation, put it into the recon, you know, and spend an extraordinary amount of time, okay? Or you have a case, you know, all of us were naming our specialty cases where we had to spend an extraordinary amount of time. So we think some type of approach where you have a base fee that compensates, you know, for the effort that it takes really to review a file and determine reconsideration and temporary disability is at issue, a base fee with an opportunity for a claimant's attorney or claimant to file a statement to ask for additional fees. So some type of approach like that may cover what we need. The second comment is that 656.383 was instituted to get away from fees that were attached to the amount of compensation that our clients were awarded. Because I've had to litigate cases all the way to the Court of Appeals about, you know, a fraction of a week being included in the average weekly wage. Perhaps financially may have meant only a small amount of temporary disability, but would have greater impacts on permanent disability. And it took an extraordinary effort of an appellate case to establish that. And those few days make a difference, because we don't want to have a system that allows or encourages insurers to cut off a few cents of a worker in any way. Those cents or dollars make a big difference to the client, and the statute was intended to compensate the attorneys for their efforts to allow that litigation to go forward. So the table that ties the attorney fee to the amount of temporary disability, we don't prefer that. We don't think that's the wisest way to institute or implement the statute. And so perhaps just a base fee with an opportunity to file another statement of services that would then follow the jurisdiction of the, follow the jurisdiction for the reconsideration order would probably be a better way to go. We think that the fee should be determined by the agency, whether it be at the department or the hearings division, whoever has jurisdiction. And we don't think that initially it should be determined in any way by the insurance company. I'm not sure adding to the insurance company's burden of having to do these calculations is helpful, certainly in the current environment when everyone is sort of strung out a little bit, but we don't think that's a good policy decision to implement into the statutes to put the insurance company as the determiner of a fee. So I have some other comments, but I'll just throw that out as sort of our general discussion of what we saw as a way to approach this problem. And certainly I invite other people to comment, other claimants attorneys who have really more perspective than I do on this. Thank you.
Chris, it looks like you've come off of mute as well. Did you want to add to what Julene?
So first, I do agree with what Julene had to say, but my interest is in starting a little further upstream. Due and payables, for me, is problematic. The Court of Appeals said that the issue, the statute says obtain, and the Court of Appeals says, well, that's a broader term than awarded. And I have cases, one now pending at the Workers' Compensation Board, where my client did not appear to be entitled to additional temporary disability benefits with the initial rescission of the notice of closure, but subsequent closure demonstrates that he was in fact entitled to additional temporary disability benefits. And, I think we talked about this before. This is a extremely complicated situation. We are going to have to litigate probably the definition of obtained, and that's going to go on in a couple different cases that at least that I have at the Workers' Compensation Board right now. But to me, if it's broader than awarded, the question isn't whether the money actually gets paid. It is whether it is actually, whether that entitlement is obtained. And there can be a variety of reasons why it doesn't get paid. From reducing an overpayment, that's not actually paid to the claimant, but I think that the benefit was obtained and there's an attorney's fee that's entitled. The issue that's in Dancing Bear of the suspension, whether, and of course the timing on that suspension is going to be important, but if the benefit is obtained and it is not paid because of some other technical reason, from my perspective, that looks like an attorney's fee is warranted. And I would just echo Julene's comments. The change in the law was, and the Court of Appeals in Dancing Bear even cited this, that, this is a change that was designed to make sure that lawyers are willing to take these cases on, and you need to make sure that the amount paid ensures that that'll happen. I too had a case that went, for me, it went to the Supreme Court, where because of the way attorney fees were paid on time loss at the time, I got a $35 attorney's fee, and taking the case all the way to the Supreme Court. I think that our legislature recognizes that it's crazy. They asked me to donate, at that time would have been about $15,000. Now it would be significantly more. So I don't know that I have a solution for those problems. And again, Julian is also correct. The significant majority of these cases are going to be pretty straightforward. You get an additional month of time loss or several weeks of time loss, and that you can probably we could all probably agree on a reasonable method for compensating claimant's counsel. We might have some separation about what that amount would be, but I think we could probably get to a reasonable way to do it. But the tricky part is solving these more complex cases where notice of closure is set aside. And so really, those would be my comments at this point.
Thank you. Any other claimants' attorneys who would like to add on to what Julina and Chris have already said? I'm just looking through to see if I see any hands or anybody else. Okay, would anybody else like to comment on either what you've heard so far or what's in the draft rule?
I can go. Saline Schooler with Safe Corporation. And, you know, we've had an opportunity to review these rules as well and really appreciate the department's gathering of information and looking at orders to ensure there's consistency in the system and what is being awarded, and try to create a process that is streamlined and easy for the parties to implement. When we were looking at this and whether it would be a process that SAFE could implement, we do have already systems in place for completing audits of time loss awards when there is an adjustment in the reconsideration order, and issuing payment for that or applying it to an overpayment, and also issuing attorney fees. So we feel that the system that is in the rule is very workable for us. It could be folded into our existing processes in a manner that's not overly burdensome, because we're already calculating that time loss amount. Applying the fee matrix is something that we could do here with relative ease. And then Mr. Moore brought up the overpayment recovery piece, and that was something that we had discussed at the last meeting regarding Dancing Bear and its effects and how that should be applied. We would agree that when there is an overpayment and time loss that would have otherwise been paid to the worker is then applied towards that overpayment, that is a benefit that is being payable to the worker through the offset, and should not diminish an attorney fee in that instance, because that is money and a benefit that the worker is receiving. The due and payable versus obtained piece outside of that arena is a little trickier. I can think of instances where time loss dates are modified, there's no overpayment, and there's no time loss that the worker obtains even with the time loss date modification, because of the way the dates are adjusted, it still results in a net zero payment to the worker. So the approach that WCD has taken here, I think, aligns with that type of situation and can also align with the overpayment piece, though it may require additional clarification that in that instance, an attorney fee would still be warranted, because that is a benefit being secured to the worker and applied to their claim. The last piece too, it was Ms. Quinn's suggestion of having a base fee and then having claimant's attorney submit statements of services. We do see that before the hearings division. It is something that is selectively used, sometimes more often by certain attorneys, and in other cases not used at all. Certainly one thing that we're looking to avoid is an argument or a fight over attorney fees as part of that reconsideration order, and arguing about time devoted to a case or complexity of the issues. As Ms. Quinn indicated, but the majority of these cases are pretty simplistic. The request for reconsideration is made, the records are sent over by the insurer, and a review occurs, and then the adjustment flows from that. For those 20% cases where there are more significant time loss benefits at issue and that results in a significant award to the worker, we feel that this rule contemplates that in the current attorney fee matrix by increasing the percentage that is paid to the claimant's attorney in addition to the base fee. We feel that this rule as a whole is workable, it's reasonable, and it's consistent with what is being awarded in other areas or by other bodies in this area of litigation. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine.
This is Melissa Douglas. I just have just two questions about the rule and the matrix and the out-of-compensation benefit. You mentioned that the new rule with the base fee and then the percentage, so base fee plus percentage of additional benefits that are due and payable, that total amount, so in the example, the total fee of $934.80 is a assessed fee to the worker's attorney, and then also there would be the straight up 10% out of compensation under this rule. Am I understanding that right?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And then I just had a question just for myself, and maybe I should ask it outside the forum, but currently, do claimants' counsel get 10% out of compensation for reduction in overpayment created by an order on recon?
And that's something I'm not sure I'm in a position to answer that, because right now the statute just says that the worker's attorney gets 10% of the additional compensation awarded, which includes temporary disability and permanent disability, and the reconsideration order contains the boilerplate language to that effect, but I don't know that we know what's actually paid by the insurer once that order is issued. I don't know if anybody else wants to comment on that.
Maybe people don't know. And I guess I think it's not, but that's literally a guess. And maybe different insurance companies are handling that differently, that the 10% out of compensation is not paid to claimants to counsel when it's simply a reduction in overpayment to the worker. But I'm just guessing. And the only reason I want to know the current way it's being applied is because I think that would help look at the overpayment issue regard how it's treated for assessed fees.
Yeah. Just looking at anybody else have any comments about either the draft rule or what you've heard so far? Otherwise, I have a couple of questions. I'd like to go back to Julian for a minute, but I want to make sure everybody gets a chance to comment first. I'm not seeing anybody. Okay, Julian, if you don't mind, I have a question about how in those more complex cases where you would want the ability to ask for more. In the reconsideration proceeding before ARU, when there's a set time frame and once the order issues, I'm just wondering, how do you see that working before ARU, or do you, or is that something that would go to the hearings division to determine?
Right. So two things. I believe that the ability of the department to award a fee sits with the department's jurisdiction at the time the department has the matter in front of them. So that, for example, if you had a case where an attorney did a lot of work like the cases where you're litigating time loss before at a hearing and suddenly it gets roped into reconsideration, an attorney might have an opportunity to submit a statement to ARU for ARU to award, a fee based upon the effort. That's an option and a possibility jurisdictionally. Once you issue the reconsideration order, then it goes to the board's jurisdiction. Now, the request for an attorney fee, I kind of disagree with rule number 3 of the 04XX rule, because for a few things. First of all, a 383 fee is not, it may arise out of the reconsideration process. It is not tied to the reconsideration process in the sense that it is not bound by the limitations of 268 for a frozen record, or to actually have to have raised that issue, or that it is tied time-wise for any appeal. Chris Moore has used the example of where something is rescinded, reconsideration rescinds a closure. I don't think you have to appeal that reconsideration order, ask for a 383 fee, and hold it in abeyance until you can prove later that the next closure awarded additional time loss because of your efforts in getting the claim, the closure rescinded, triggering your client's entitlement. I don't think 383 has those time limitations, and so I don't think a rule can limit the time limitations by saying that the 331 fee is tied to the reconsideration order in any way. I agree with the second sentence that it's not a dispute under the director's jurisdiction under 7042A. I agree with that statement. I would write it a little differently. But I don't think it arises out of recon that you necessarily have to raise it by appealing the recon. And the reason I say that or why that is important is, you know, sometimes I have to appeal the recon order because of a penalty. You know, I thought it was a bad closure, unreasonable closure, and I end up appealing the recon order. And so I put that rescission at issue at a hearing, and that kind of ties my client's benefits to a hearing that I may not want to. In other words, I may agree that the closure should have been rescinded, and I agree with the order on reconsideration, but I believe that a penalty now has to be issued. And so it pits my client's penalty against the propriety of the order because it puts the propriety of the order at issue at hearing. And it may jeopardize the employer now wanting to counter cross issue saying, oh, no, the closure was fine. And so I don't think that our fees in any way should ever be tied, not tied to the benefits of the worker. I'm not saying that. But we shouldn't have to pull their benefits along with it. And so a rule has to be written that allows, that at least doesn't prevent the argument of the being able to just go to a hearing and argue, I get a fee because this is what happened. So, I mean, I sort of envision a rule that would provide a base fee that we would have to discuss that is not tied to the amount of the compensation, so we don't have these tricky calculations later, but that gives the claimant the right to either request a different fee from Recon, if that's possible, if you can provide that information, and then would also give the allow the worker to request a fee at a hearing and provide evidence about that, since it would not be a closed record. I looked at 268 again and considered 283 and the actual language in the statute and the fact that 383 is a separate statute all the way together. And I don't see a good legal argument. I'm sure someone will make it, but I don't see that the 383 fee is based upon a closed record. So anyway, that's probably more than you asked for.
But it's good feedback. I appreciate that. Thank you. Any other thoughts about Julian's comments regarding Section 3 of the rule? And for those of you, if anyone, Section 3, the second sentence of Section 3, disputes regarding attorney fees under ORS 656-3831 in reconsideration proceedings under ORS 656-268 are not matters under ORS 656-704 sub 2 sub A. And the reason behind that language, if you get into matters that are within the director's jurisdiction versus matters that are within the board's jurisdiction, there's different appeal routes. And that was an attempt to clarify that these fees should go to the hearings division. We're not wanting to institute two different routes so that the reconsideration goes one way and the attorney fee goes a different way. I don't think that's the best way for this to be resolved. So, but Julian, I appreciate your thoughts on the first sentence there. I'll have to take a look at that. Any other thoughts or any department staff, if you have any questions about what's been raised so far, please feel free to interject as well. Okay. I'll have to go back to my notes for a minute just to make sure I didn't have any other questions.
Abby.
This is Jennifer. I believe Jolene Quinn had raised her hand again.
Oh, I missed it if you did. Thank you.
I did, but if you wanted to go on, I did want to discuss that our general feeling about the amount of the base fee, you know, what we discussed as claimants' attorneys is that the world does not see all the work that goes into the effort of a reconsideration request. It may seem like I have a legal assistant fill out a form and that's it, but in the reality, and we do see a broad array of practices, but the bell curve, the vast majority of the attorneys, few as we are, practicing this, what you're going to have is, and please, others, please, you know,